One might say that I had the perfect making of a Unitarian Universalist. I grew up in a multi-faith household with a Jewish mom and a Christian dad, and I always identified with both. I loved that multiple traditions could exist within me, because we are so much more than singularities or even binaries. We house entire universes within us. And for me, I am Jewish and I am Christian. And that's never been something to deny. In fact, it brought me to Unitarian Universalism and inspired me to pursue ministry, because I was invested in navigating faith-oriented conflict, and I wanted to do the work of building towards peace. The idea that religions didn't have to be in conflict with one another was foundational to who I was. Love your neighbor and welcome the stranger. These were the tenets of my two traditions. Everything else is theological guesswork, in my opinion. Looking at what to believe rather than how to live. So the universes of Judaism and Christianity happily coexisted within me. But that changed in 2004 when the Presbyterian Church, which was my dad's tradition, started to pursue divesting funds from Israel. And in New York City, where I was from, Jews and Christians found each other at odds with one another. Like most Jews at the time, I was a staunch supporter of Israel. I joined my college Zionist group, and I was adamant that divestment was not the path forward. I certainly disagreed with Israeli policies and wanted to work towards a two-state solution. But overall, I had a huge amount of faith in the moral character of the state of Israel, because I thought that surely a Jewish state would embody the two phrases that were the center of our tradition, to love your neighbor and welcome the stranger. But that faith was misplaced, because most of us only learned the history of Israel from one side, the unbridled joy of Jews finally having a homeland, with virtually no mention of the Nakba, which was the forced displacement and violent removal of 750,000 Palestinians in 1948. I often look back at this version of myself, knowing my intentions were good, knowing that we defined Zionism very differently than the ultra-right-wing Zionists who currently wield power do. But still, it's awfully hard to admit when you're on the wrong side of justice. And yet, I was. And over 20 years later, the landscape is somehow both so similar and so vastly different. It's been over 2 years now of decimation and famine in Gaza. And we've also watched the subject become an epicenter of fear, hate, and censorship here in America, with progressives and conservatives largely arguing for opposing sides. But even today, Jews aren't a monolith when it comes to Israel-Palestine. Even when it comes to like-minded progressive Jews, there's almost always a huge diversity of opinions about Israel and the ongoing atrocities in Gaza. So it's important for me to say that as someone with a Jewish identity, I don't speak for the Jewish people. But I do speak for my Judaism, when I say that one of the biggest barriers to our collective action is trauma responses that want to quantify those whose suffering is or has been worse. Because it invariably leads to a panic response and an end to dialogue. I was having a conversation with one of my Jewish friends the other day who told me about seeing a UU minister with a t-shirt that said Free Palestine. And she was absolutely devastated, telling me it was clear that UUs no longer felt Jewish people had worth. And I was baffled, absolutely baffled, because I didn't understand how she got from a Free Palestine t-shirt to brazen genocidal anti-Semitism. But eventually, it became clear that Free Palestine, to her, meant destroy Israel. What she heard in that moment was a call to genocide against Jews, not the simple statement of solidarity to end genocide in Gaza that was actually being said. And when we dug a little deeper, she agreed that what was happening in Gaza was horrific. She had absolutely no love for Netanyahu, but she couldn't quite wrap her mind around the idea that solidarity with the people being starved today could coexist with the same level of disgust about the Holocaust. In her world, you had to choose which one was worse to ensure it never happened again. And my heart sank as I listened to this person that I know is deeply empathetic and loving, because her nervous system couldn't quite quiet the panic enough to seek common solidarity, which was the lesson that I always took away from my biblical studies. Our hearts shouldn't need to quantify pain in order to feel empathy for Palestinians and Israelis. And I don't want to relinquish my humanity in the name of one side's collective trauma. But so often, when we try to move from the raw emotions to common action, the comparisons come crawling back. Because there's so much fear, like for my friend, that the end result will be another Holocaust. Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg once said that all too often Jews wear our trauma as a shield and a sword. But part of the insidious nature of trauma means that we're not always aware when trauma has the wheels. And for the majority of American Jews, a trauma response, even if it's a little one, awakens within us when the subject of Israel comes up. So many Jews have an automatic response from their nervous system telling them that criticism and condemnation of Israel are somehow criticism and condemnation of Jewish people's right to exist in the world, which is very rarely what's being said by those who simply want Palestinians to be safe and free. This was one of the reasons why, when I was 20, I was so opposed to divestment. We needed everyone at the table talking to each other. We needed to promote models that didn't alienate anyone. Models like the amazing organizations on the ground doing work of healing like Seeds of Peace, or Parents Circle, which is an organization founded by and for Israelis and Palestinians whose loved ones have been murdered. I remember being so thoroughly convinced that divestment was not the answer. But ultimately, I had to reckon with the reality that my perspective was privilege and power talking. with a shield of Jewish trauma to prevent me from looking at my location. Because American Jews could come to the dialogue table, even if it was uncomfortable. Israeli Jews could come to the table and make their voices known, even if they were uncomfortable. But the majority of Palestinians living in Gaza and in the West Bank quite literally could not. Between checkpoints and raids and stolen homes, there was never a table for the average Palestinian to come to and discuss peace. It was a fantasy table I was imagining. And it took working with kids and young adults from regions of conflict to really understand how trauma had been a shield for me to hide behind. The organization was called Face to Face, Faith to Faith. And it was a camp for teenagers from Israel-Palestine, South Africa, Northern Ireland, and the US. And it focused on dialogue to create future leaders in peace work. I was a counselor there, facilitating dialogue with these incredible kids. The more stories that I heard, the more it became impossible to ignore the echoes between Israel, Palestine, and apartheid South Africa. Israel was and is an apartheid state, and it was and is an occupying force. Even as I stared at these incontrovertible evidence of these truths, I still couldn't quite get myself to support divestment, because I had hung so much of my identity, my Jewish identity, on the idea that investing in peace called for more investment, not less. But my friends in South Africa had a lesson for me there too. Lessons for all of us who struggled so mightily with the idea that divestment would be, quote unquote, pulling support from Israel. That as sad as it is, money often has more sway than all of our protests combined. And that very fact led to the fall of apartheid in South Africa. Boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. A collective commitment to make apartheid unprofitable toppled the system there, even if extreme wealth discrepancies still persist today. And as important as healing work is, work that's still underway in South Africa, it doesn't replace the need to disempower those who are wantonly using it for oppression and subjugation. When the atrocities began to unfold in Gaza, I realized that there was a newfound call to invest in peace. But this time, I came with the knowledge of apartheid history. This time, I'd been trained within my ministry to know that peace does not exist without accountability. This time, I knew that divestment wasn't withdrawing love from an entire people. It was the act of expressing it for all people and calling those in power to do the same. Because they won't do what's right on their own. And power doesn't relinquish itself. Long ago, after World War II, Jews came up with an agreement of sorts, a phrase of empowerment and self-determination. Never again. But how many genocides have taken place since 1945 that we chose to look away from, as was done to us? When never again refers only to one people, we've missed the point entirely, because it defeats the purpose of the phrase. Never again should mean that genocide, mass murder, and subjugation are hard lines never to be crossed by anyone. And it needs to apply to everyone, or in reality, it applies to no one. Never again means decrying terrorism, decrying occupation, and decrying genocide. Love your neighbor and welcome the stranger are the tenets of our faith. So when we say never again, that can't only apply to October 7th. It must also apply to decades of oppression and occupation, years of settler violence in the West Bank, and to the 2 years of atrocities in Gaza. Never again means rejecting apartheid and refusing to enable it. Because taking money away from subjugation and genocide is an act of love, an act of welcome, an act that seeks a true homeland, that loves our neighbor and welcomes the stranger. The now famous Montgomery bus boycott was a perfect example of that here in America. For over a year following the arrest of Rosa Parks, Black men and women boycotted the segregation bus system that forced Black riders to sit in the back and stand upon request. They were pressured into using the bus again with a lot of tactics, including making carpooling illegal. But still, they refused to give their money or their time to the Montgomery Bus Company. And after a lower court, followed by the Supreme Court, declared the practice unconstitutional, they continued to boycott for another month until desegregation was fully implemented. But imagine how much faster integration would have happened if thousands of white patrons had boycotted too. Segregation was America's apartheid. And with the current administration, its return is possible. So our call, the call to love our neighbor and welcome the stranger, is to make apartheid unprofitable and impossible to maintain, so that it can be toppled as it was in South Africa. When I was in my 20s, investing in peace meant avoiding sources of conflict and choosing to place energy into programs that are doing vital work. And those programs still matter. But I was wrong, because I asked nothing of those in power. Nothing of the people responsible for decades of occupation and years of genocide. Even if there is technically a ceasefire right now. In the old adage, to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, my earlier approach sought to comfort the afflicted without afflicting the comfortable. And at the end of the day, that means nothing will change, because power does not relinquish itself. So my invitation to you is to join me in putting down the trauma shield that beckons us to look away and let love be our true guide towards peace. Because peace is hard work, but true peace refuses to negotiate with apartheid. True peace builds up a new way of relating to the world, an apartheid-free world. And that movement, now with hundreds of faith-based organizations and congregations behind it, is one I'm now proud to call myself a member of. I hope you'll join me in this endeavor, that we may truly love our neighbor and welcome the stranger, because only then will there be peace. Blessed be and amen.